In this episode, we bust some myths associated with the common mental disorder that is bipolar disorder. We dive deep into explaining what life is like for someone with bipolar and the symptoms, causes, treatment they might experience. Then stay tuned as we answer your questions in our Q&A segment. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode. My name is Kat. I am one of your co-hosts and I am a registered psychologist.
And I'm Amy, the other half of the Psychology Sisters. And today we are talking all things bipolar disorder. But before we jump into today's episode, Kat, sweet, sweet angel face Kat, how are you? Tell me about your week.
A few more adjectives, please.
No, you get sweet, sweet angel face.
Okay. Well, look, that'll have to do. My week was wonderful. I have just been very busy. Obviously, it's been a very strange week because of everything that's happening in Melbourne. So I just wanted to send our love to Melbourne at the moment. It's a really hard time and we just hope that everyone is staying safe and well. But yeah, apart from that, really not much. Just my usual antics of working full time and...
Have you got a pit and a peak for us this week?
I do have a pit. It's more of a little blooper. I actually didn't tell you about this.
I love bloopers.
I was at the gym the other day and I was in the middle of, you know, when sometimes you're at the gym and you're just not feeling it. And then you have times where you're like, yeah, I feel like such a boss. Like me picking up this 3 kilo dumbbell, like an absolute queen. Here I am, like, feeling really confident about myself. And I was holding on to, like, the cable machine. And it kind of got stuck. And it was kind of recoiling because, obviously, my weight was too heavy. I was too overambitious with my gym equipment. And it kind of recoiled back. And in the process, it split my nail. Like, it ripped off my nail. And I've got really strong nails. So when they rip off, it kills. So I'm awkwardly bleeding on the gym floor in the middle of coronavirus, like trying not to get my blood everywhere. Oh, and the gym lady was like, yeah, girl, you're going to have to leave. I was like, I just want to finish my workout. I was feeling so good and so confident. And here I am, humbled back down to earth, like the absolute idiot that I am. But here I am.
That is honestly the worst pain. Like such kills. A tiny, weeny little part of the body. So sensitive. Like, you know, that nail bed, once the nail is gone, like, and you always brush it. Like,
yeah.
It's like, so sensitive. I never noticed. Yeah. And it's like, you don't notice how often you like brush your hands against things until you've ripped off a nail and every single thing you do, like just touches that sensitive spot.
So far
spot.
Down. Like it wasn't even just the tip of the nail. I feel like it's halfway down my nail and it's disgusting. So yeah, I was just a bleeding mess. And
again,
but yes, I'm fine. Perspective with everything that's happened this week, that's totally nothing. I'm not complaining. And my peak would be, do you know what? I'm having a bit of a week of feeling very grateful. I am happy to be alive. And actually, I do have a recommendation for anyone that hasn't watched Lion. Have you seen Lion on Netflix?
I have.
Oh my gosh. I was having a little whinge to Josh about, oh, poor me, my nail, the wedding. Like it's, you know, I was just having a moment and I watched Lion and I was like, you know what? I've got fresh water. I've got a roof over my head. Everything else is a bonus. So that really brought me back down to earth.
Such a great movie, Lion. Such a beautiful movie.
It's beautiful. He does that Aussie accent so well.
I was
shook. I was like, how are you nailing this? Nobody nails an Aussie accent. So can confirm, please go and watch Lion. What about you, my darling Amy? How was your week and pit and peak?
Okay, my pit is also a little bit of a blooper. Something funny and equally embarrassing that happened. I went into work over a little bit of my break to do some like organizing, you know, resource gathering, printing, all that fun stuff to get me organized going back to work. And when you walk into the building, you know, you have to sign in. And now, because of COVID restrictions and precautions, they often take your temperature. And this was the first time that had really happened to me. So the lovely office lady at the head office of where I work, said, okay, I'm just going to take your temperature now. So then I stood there in front of her with my mouth open, waiting for her to take my temperature.
Like a 7-year-old at the doctor's surgery.
They all started hysterically laughing.
So this is your workplace, where the place that pays you to be a professional.
Head office, like all the professionals that's tough, laughing at me. And then she like whips out this little temperature gun and says, no, I literally just need to point this at your forehead.
Wow.
So I was like, oh, haha, I'm joking too.
What were you waiting for? Like, is that how people usually check temperature?
Well, I expected her to whip out the little thermometer that goes in your mouth.
How long ago did you get your last temperature check, Amy?
Really unhygienic.
How old are you, like 4 years old?
I must have been, but like, it was just kind of an automatic response, you know.
Science has progressed, Amy.
At least I didn't present her with my bottom. Like, that would have been...
Yeah, that would have been awkward. Imagine if the boss came downstairs and here you are.
And I'm just like, just waiting for my temperature to be taken. No, look. I couldn't see. It could have been worse.
That's amazing.
Anyway, moving right along. Let us get into today's episode. As I mentioned before, today we are talking all things bipolar disorder.
We thought this would be a really good episode to do because obviously a lot of things are happening at the moment. There's lots of narrative and chatter around bipolar, given everything happening with Kanye West and his run for the US presidency. So, Ames, tell me about what you know about what's happening with Kanye.
Yeah, well, I actually didn't really know about this whole Kanye's mental health being highlighted in the media until you messaged me because we had organized to do an episode on bipolar disorder just because, you know, we love mental health and think it's great to bring awareness to different mental health disorders. And I did read Kim Kardashian's spiel on her husband's struggle with bipolar, and I thought what she said was beautiful. I think she did mental health in general such justice, and especially showed a little bit of insight into what it might be like being in a relationship with someone who does suffer from bipolar.
Yeah, I think it really shows just how far mental health and the destigmatization has come. I think obviously 20 years ago, people would have labeled him crazy and insane and, you know, would have dismissed that behavior completely or put it down to something that was just unexplainable or put it almost back on him. But now that there is that progress, I feel like a little bit more awareness that there was a bit of a change in the narrative in the media that I noticed. I mean, still, there are lots of people who were degrading him and his behavior and putting it down to, I guess, quote, insanity. But I really liked that there were actually quite a few media outlets who were highlighting bipolar and exactly what it is and listing symptoms and, I guess, spreading that awareness and almost providing that empathetic viewpoint for Kanye, which is actually a huge pivotal turning point for the media. And I think that was really nice to see just a few of those news articles circulating that were, if anything, more empathetic than insulting. So I really liked seeing that. I thought that's such a huge step for mental health and the destigmatization of bipolar, because as you and I always say, anxiety and depression, they have come such a long way in destigmatizing certain things like bipolar, schizophrenia, any personality disorders, any disorders that have that.
Psychosis,
dissociation, substance abuse, they're still got a lot of stigma around them. So as awful as what's happened with Kanye, it's been quite good in a way because it's really highlighted exactly what bipolar is and taken away some of the blame off him.
Well, I think just like with anxiety and depression, the more it's talked about, the more awareness is circulated, the more people develop an understanding for the disorder, and the more understanding and education we have around something that really aids in the destigmatization, as you're saying. So I think though this is, you know, been pretty awful for Kanye West and Kim Kardashian to go through, it's really, really shed some light on bipolar and, you know, some bipolar disorder is quite common. And I feel like this has maybe really increased others' awareness as to, you know, what it might be like to live with bipolar.
But I just wonder, I mean, I wonder if people who suffer from bipolar, I wonder their thoughts on seeing this in media and if they think that's an accurate representation, if they think, you know, it's, you know, it'd be really interesting to get that perspective. But I think overall, just education is so important for mental health.
Opening up those conversations.
Yeah. So we wanted to dive in about everything to do with bipolar. So Amy, take it away for me. Sis, what is bipolar? Give me a rough definition.
Okay, so you might have heard the term bipolar to describe someone who is moody or, you know, maybe seems a little bit hot and cold. However, bipolar disorders are so much more than that. They are a pretty serious mental health disorder, and they are extreme fluctuations in a person's mood, energy, and ability to function. So people with bipolar disorder experience periods of great excitement and overactivity, delusions, and euphoria, and that is known as mania. And then they experience other periods of really low sadness and hopelessness, known as depression.
So I guess we'll preface here that nobody experiences bipolar in exactly the same way. You know, we think of mental health, every mental health disorder, as on a spectrum. So people can perhaps experience more severe, more frequent episodes and bouts of mania, and more frequent and intense bouts of depression, or they can experience less intense and less severe. So it really is all on a scale. But generally, as Ames said, it is characterized by that, you know, the high highs and the mania and then the low lows with the depression. And also want to mention that bipolar is mostly episodic. It's not consistent. People who suffer from bipolar don't stay in that manic state their whole life. They also don't stay in the depressed state their whole life. It's more episodic. And most of the time, people with bipolar have long periods of being well and productive and being engaged with their family and going to work. So there is this baseline that a lot of people with bipolar do sit at. It's just real episodic with the highs and the lows. So that's one, I guess, stereotype that people with perceived bipolar is they're always manic or they're always depressed. There's never an in-between. But actually most of the time, a lot of people, not all people, sit on that baseline.
Yeah, definitely. And there are a couple of different types, well, three different types of bipolar disorder as well. There is bipolar 1, which is where the person suffering from bipolar 1 will have really, really intense ups and downs. So they will have really high mania and depressive episodes. So they're really dramatic mood swings. So during a manic episode, people with bipolar 1 disorder may feel high and on top of the world, or really uncomfortable and irritable. Or some people describe it as being wired. They feel like they're, you know, really super fast, and they feel just like, you know, super wired. And then during the depressive episode, they may feel really helpless and sad and worthless. So bipolar 1 disorder is probably the more dramatic and intense of the three. Then there's bipolar 2 disorder, which consists of depressive and manic episodes, which alternate. However, they're not as dramatic as bipolar 1. And they have what's called as hypomanic episodes. So that is mania, but not as severe as bipolar 1. So people return to usual function between episodes with bipolar 2, and people with bipolar 2 often seek treatment because of their depressive symptoms. And they often have co-occurring mental illnesses as well, like anxiety. And then we have cyclothymia, or cyclic disorder. And what that basically means is the person experiencing bipolar disorder cycle back and forth between episodes of hypomania and depression. So it's a milder form of bipolar, and it involves the mood swings, hypomania, depressive symptoms, and they occur a little bit more constantly. People with cyclothymia experience emotional up and downs, but with a bit less severe symptoms than what they would in bipolar 1 or 2.
So think about, you know, bipolar. Bi obviously means two, and polar means having a spectrum. So bipolar is characterized by the two extremes, isn't it? It's having that evidence of the manic episodes and the high manic episodes, the feeling of the buzz, the up, the productivity, the lots of energy versus having that real lows of the depression. So you can see how bipolar in its nature is really just meaning experiencing both ends of the spectrum and quite a severe level. So as Ames was saying, there's three different types and they all experience the highs and lows differently with either more severity, more intensity or less. So Ames, tell me about some common misconceptions that people might have about bipolar.
I think the one that really stands out to me the most, that's, you know, such a common misconception, and I think it can be really, harmful for those that do experience bipolar, and that is that mania is an enjoyable, kind of productive and fun thing to go through, to experience. That is so false. A full mania episode can be really dangerous and extreme, and it can lead to recklessness. Like a lot of people with bipolar 1 disorder in particular can do things like invest all their money into, you know, on a whim, into an investment, or they'll gamble, or they'll have, you know, that really reckless, impulsive, big life decisions during a full mania episode. It can also feel like I said, you're wired. So you constantly have these racing thoughts, like rapid fire, and you have that really pressured speech. So it's like you just cannot switch off. And untreated, and I say untreated, so no intervention at all, manic episodes can last for 3 to 6 months. So this can be a severely debilitating disorder if untreated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that misconception that going through a manic episode, it doesn't automatically mean that people are violent or dangerous if they're going through a manic episode. And I think that when you hear bipolar, you instantly think, oh gosh, you know, they're dangerous, or they are violent, or they're aggressive, or they're just really, you know, impulsive. And I think, yeah, that a part of that is true with the impulsivity, but it doesn't automatically make them dangerous, or it doesn't make them a threat. You know, everyone experiences mania differently. So it's hard, bipolar, because I think there is that stigma that it's immediately dangerous and immediately people need to be locked up. But that's not the case at all, because everybody experiences it so differently.
Definitely. And I think there's also too, because there is such a stigma around disorders like bipolar, that it must be really rare, or, you know, if you have it, you must be, you know, really, really psychotic or crazy to have bipolar. But like Kat mentioned, there's a spectrum, and bipolar disorder is not that rare. It's actually quite common. Mm-hmm. It's a quite common psychological disorder to have, and lots of people find ways to treat they're bipolar and live normal, healthy lives.
I think also with this diagnosis with bipolar, it's not something that is instantly diagnosed. I think it does take a bit of time with a therapist or a GP or a doctor to go through the patterns. I think in my experience, I've seen that because there is those low lows, doctors might generally prescribe antidepressants, and it's often mistreated or misdiagnosed, especially when you're younger. It's not until, I guess, the pattern emerges when clients are a little bit older that it is diagnosed properly. So it can easily be misdiagnosed as depression or sometimes ADHD. I've had a few clients where that's happened. And I think with bipolar, it's good to know. Yeah, anxiety. Yeah. And often, you know, there are dual diagnoses, but if it's not, you know, picked up properly and it's not diagnosed properly, it can have some pretty detrimental effects, because going into the medications that are really helpful for bipolar, antidepressants on their own can sometimes make bipolar symptoms worse. So it's just about getting the right treatment and the right diagnosis and early intervention. But often that's not the case. It can take a bit of time to nut that out and, you know, have a really good clinician who can pick up on that. But it is a bit tricky in the beginning, especially for kids as well. Diagnosis with kids it's difficult.
Yeah, definitely. So some of the signs and symptoms that someone with bipolar might, I guess, experience, or if you are a family member or a friend of someone with bipolar, you might observe increased talkativeness, increased self-esteem and grandiosity, decreased need for sleep, increase in goal direct activity, you know, increased in energy level, or even irritability, racing thoughts, poor attention, increased risk taking. So exactly like we were saying before, that, you know, spending money, sexualized behaviors, with hypermania, which is that less extreme mania, it will be more of the high energy symptoms on a day-to-day basis. You might also see a decrease in responsibilities. So if, you know, if you have a colleague at work, you might notice that they tend to, you know, drop off on their work responsibilities. And I think that's where the stereotype that someone with bipolar can't hold down a job comes from. That's a myth. They can hold down a job if their bipolar is treated. It's just that when they are in that hypermania or mania stage, it obviously, you know, there's that impulsivity, they're wired, it's, you know, they're in that really high energy level state. So it's very, very hard for them to concentrate and attend to one task. And it can, and then that can also lead to depression. So then that's where we see that really big up and down with bipolar.
Isn't that hard? I mean, trying to maintain function normally with work, with friends, with hobbies, with kids, you've got the high highs and the low lows. You know, that's really difficult. It's not just you've got the highs and your baseline, you've got baseline highs and then lows. So trying to hold down a job when you're feeling that real major depression is like you naturally want to withdraw. You might want to sleep more, you might want to sleep less. And then as well, when you're feeling the high highs. So it's really difficult for someone with bipolar, but as we were saying, you know, it's treated properly, people with bipolar can go on to live very normal lives.
Yeah, definitely. I think what's also important to mention too is that bipolar disorder affects men and women equally, but women are 3 times more likely to experience rapid cycling of mood episodes, and they're also more likely to experience depressive and mixed episodes of the disorder. And I probably should have mentioned those two things when I was talking about the different types of bipolar. So when I say mixed episodes, a person with bipolar can actually experience depression and mania at the same time. And rapid cycling is when a person with bipolar might experience 4 or more episodes within 1 year. So that's just a little extra info on bipolar.
Holistic statistic. It's back, baby. And I think that's interesting with the men versus women. I know for men it does typically onset of being diagnosed with bipolar or symptoms of bipolar is a lot earlier in life for men than it is for females. And manic episodes in men are generally more common and more severe than they are for women, which is really interesting. And like we're saying before, during manic episodes, men are more likely to be prone to those aggressive behaviors. We're not saying that every man who has bipolar is going to do that. It's just in terms of the gender differences, there is certainly that men are more tend to turn to that aggression, which is actually quite normal in a lot of mental health concerns with men. Is it's almost like that coping mechanism, isn't it? And for women, often I've been doing some research today, women are more likely to be misdiagnosed, as I was saying before, with major depressive disorder. Isn't that interesting? And I wonder why. I wonder whether that's a lack of self-report from the client. Maybe the GP hasn't picked up on it or screened it properly. I wonder if there's embarrassment about the manic episodes or a dismissive, I get a bit frustrated sometimes. Maybe it's just interesting that perhaps women don't disclose the manic episodes as much as men do.
Manic episodes are harder to identify as abnormal because when you're experiencing, especially something like hypermania, which isn't as severe as mania, you feel good. It's not necessarily an alarming or negative state. So for a lot of the time, especially if you're not in a really severe state of or really intense state of hypermania, it's really hard to identify that something isn't right. Whereas obviously when you are depressed and you're feeling super low and hopeless, that is a lot more easy to identify as something not quite being right.
Yeah, because there's that negative emotion attached to it. And I wonder as well, if you have, obviously bipolar, it's mostly from genetic predisposition. If you had lived with bipolar your whole life, you've had those manic episodes, you might think that that's normal, you know? And I wonder if people notice the depressive symptoms more than they would the manic symptoms. So yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? The gender differences there.
Yeah, definitely. And getting on to causes. So like with most psychological disorders, researchers don't fully understand what the exact causes of bipolar disorder are, but we have been able to identify factors which may increase your risk of developing the disorder. So people with family members, like Kat said, if you have a family member that has bipolar disorder, you are actually 10 times more likely to have bipolar disorder. So symptoms first usually emerge when you're in your teenage years or early adulthood, and generally the onset is about 25 years old. So genetic predisposition is huge, and researchers have also found that the earlier age of your parent is diagnosed, so the earlier your parent is diagnosed with the disorder, the higher your risk is for also developing it. However, genetics isn't the only factor, because twin studies show us that both twins don't always develop the disorder. So there are environmental factors as well that also play a significant role in developing bipolar disorder. So if you experience a traumatic event, you're higher at risk. Childhood abuse factors like sexual or physical abuse, neglect, death of a parent, a highly stressful event like losing your job, a really big change like, you know, moving countries or experiencing the death of a family member can also trigger a manic or a depressive episode. Also, lack of sleep has been shown to increase risk of manic episodes. And like Kat was saying before, some medications and drugs can trigger the onset of a manic or depressive episode. In particular, like you said, Kat, SSRIs, which are used as antidepressant and anxiety medication, can actually make it really difficult for someone who does have a comorbidity with depression or anxiety, because oftentimes they do go to treat the depression and then it actually triggers their manic episodes, which is not a fun time.
Not a fun time at all. Yeah. So it is... It is really tricky with bipolar, but I think once it is treated, picked up, treated and diagnosed and correctly managed, it can really, really improve. Also, just want to mention, if your parents have bipolar, it doesn't automatically mean you will get bipolar, or if you have bipolar, it doesn't automatically mean your children will. There is just that higher chance.
Yeah, it just means a little bit more likelihood.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess also going into neurological findings for bipolar, I mean, it is relatively unresearched when compared to something like schizophrenia, but researchers have found that the frontal lobe, there is a lot less gray matter in the frontal lobe of patients who have bipolar versus those who don't. So the frontal lobe is like our control panel. Frontal lobe controls things like emotional expression, problem solving, memory, judgment, language, all of those cognitive, really important cognitive functioning. So people with bipolar, the frontal lobe tends to be a lot less gray matter than with versus a patient who doesn't have bipolar. So that's, I guess, the neurological findings. It is very under researched, which is really interesting compared to some other mood or personality disorders. But I think like all mental health disorders, there is that nature versus nurture. But I think in this case, it seems as though genetic factors account for about 60 to 80% of bipolar.
So moving on to treatment options for someone with bipolar disorder, it is very treatable. So bipolar cannot be cured, quotation mark, but it is very treatable. So each person is different. Each treatment is individualized. So different people will respond to treatment in different ways. And it is about really finding a treatment that works especially for you. As with all mental health or even health conditions in general, we are all so different, but it may just mean you need to trial different medications and different therapy before finding one that works for you or for your family member or your partner.
Yeah, I think also with bipolar treatment, it's really good to have that collaborative approach, as with every mental health concern, but having that real network of people around the person who is suffering from bipolar is so crucial for recovery and management and treatment, because those are the people that will know your triggers. Those are the people that know when you're in a manic episode. Those are the people that will know when you're in your depressed episode. So really important to have those people around you, because people like doctors and therapists, they're not always around you. They're not always going to be there when you're going through those highs and those lows. So those, the people around that person who's suffering from bipolar is so crucial for treatment.
100%, especially with something like bipolar, because you know, you're experiencing two completely different ends of the spectrum. And sometimes, well, oftentimes actually, CBT and talk therapy isn't the most effective intervention for treating the manic episodes of bipolar disorder, but it is a great tool for when you're experiencing the depressive episodes. So it's good to have a variety of tools and strategies and interventions. And as Kat said, for that to all be collaborative in your treatment plan.
Yes. I was actually listening to something interesting the other day. I can't tell you what I was listening to, but it was talking about the effect of social media on bipolar and people who were in their manic episodes. So people who were suffering from bipolar would often post more, would put more on their stories. So this is Instagram or Facebook, and they would post things that were really out of character for them. And it was interesting because there was a friend who was getting interviewed who just knew when this person was experiencing a manic episode. And that friend knew that, and the content they were sharing, they knew that they were having a manic episode and they could quickly intervene and call their network or the ambulance or whoever needed to be called. So isn't that interesting that that the social media can actually have quite a good, well, for most people, can pick up on those manic symptoms for friends, can really recognize that. So I thought that was really interesting to note. So going into treatment, so pharmacological treatment, the best, I guess, in quotation marks, the gold standard of treatment for bipolar is lithium, and that is seems to be work quite well with antidepressants. But as we were saying before, you do need a pretty thorough assessment by your GP or psychiatrist to match those two up, because sometimes with medication, it just takes a bit of trial and error. But lithium seems to be the gold standard for most treatment, for the pharmacological treatment of bipolar. Also, melatonin is really important. So melatonin is really important for that sleep-wake cycle. It's a sleeping tablet. So for people who are in their manic episodes, who don't, you know, perhaps don't feel like they're tired or don't need to sleep as much, making sure you get that melatonin in can help that body, help your body to calm down and go into that sleep-wake cycle. Because when we're tired, we can't think properly, we can't do anything properly. So, and that helps to regulate your emotions. So melatonin is really important for that, or any sleeping tablets. But as we say here, we're not here to give medication advice or pharmacological advice. That is something for a psychiatrist or a GP to do. But these are pretty common pharmacological interventions for people with bipolar. Also, interestingly, essential fatty acids have had a bit of research behind them for bipolar. So that's like your fish oil, your krill oil. So that seems to be another, I guess, in quotation marks, soft intervention.
Yeah, definitely. So we've got our mood stabilizers, our lithium salts, and I guess, yeah, practical things like diet and exercise are really great for most treatment plans when you have a psychological disorder. So exactly like we were saying, that holistic approach in looking after a lot of different areas. We've got, you know, pharmacological talk therapy like CBT or intervention from a psychologist or a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists are really great to work with because they will be able to tailor an individual treatment plan for you with other mental health professionals. And that will, I guess, enable you to better understand and rebuild your relationship with yourself.
I guess another thing that would be really important for treatment in therapy is really getting into a good routine. Routine really, really helps, especially in those manic episodes, because mania is totally losing some of that routine. It's, you know, it's not sleeping, it's not showing up for work, it's not participating in those normal activities. So routine is so, so important for people who do suffer from bipolar, particularly in those manic episodes, as much as possible. It's not always possible. So touching on their control, perhaps people who experience bipolar, in my experience, they either feel really in control of their mania or really out of control with their mania. So addressing their control over their situation and even just reshaping how they emotionally regulate and how they problem solve. I guess a lot of people with bipolar do depend on that creativity, that productivity, and they think that that's the only way they can get things done. It's just reframing that, reshaping that, and helping them to learn that they don't need that mania all the time to get their to-do list done. So it's just really reshaping a lot of their problem solving skills would be really helpful in therapy.
Yeah, definitely. Something else your therapist might suggest, or a practical tip If you or someone you know has bipolar, a mood chart or charting your mood, sometimes specific things can trigger an episode. So like Kat was saying, kind of recognizing your sleep patterns or your stress. Stress can trigger a manic episode. So recognizing these can really help you manage them more effectively and can even help you avoid them altogether as, I guess, a preventative or management strategy. And the same for practicing stress management techniques can really help calm down and prevent the onset of a manic episode.
Another thing also is support groups. Support groups are wonderful for people who might be suffering from bipolar because it helps to normalize what they're going through, and it helps to really empower people with bipolar to understand their condition and their mental health concerns even more. So I did want to mention Bipolar Australia. I Googled this afternoon, they have like a little map on their website to look up support groups. So if that's something that you feel you are suffering from or someone you know is suffering from, Bipolar Australia have those support groups. I'll leave the link in the show notes. So if that's something that people might be interested in, I think that would be another good tool for recovery is groups. Groups are wonderful. Groups are great. We always recommend groups, but I think for certainly something like bipolar, it might be really, really helpful for bipolar sufferers or their friends and family.
And speaking of family, if you are someone who is supporting a friend or a family member with bipolar, it can be really difficult. It can be really harrowing for your friends and family. So the person with bipolar may feel like they can do anything, often causing them to engage in those risky behaviors and impulsivity, things like gambling, like we were saying, or quitting their job, and other kind of, I guess, life-changing decisions when they are in those manic episodes, which can hurt themselves or loved ones. So therapy or support networks for carers is also really beneficial to help you support them, or even to support you supporting them, because it can be quite a tough gig supporting someone with bipolar or a mental disorder. The depression phase of bipolar can also be really debilitating, but in the opposite way. So if you have bipolar, not knowing how you are going to feel from one day to another on a daily basis can cause a lot of anxiety and even panic for the person experiencing bipolar, and for family members not knowing, you know, what your presentation is going to be like that day. So if you do have a friend or a family member with bipolar, there are specific ways to help, and I would recommend, I guess, consulting your friend or family member's psychiatrist or psychologist or doctor to assist them in and being consistent with the treatment plan they have been recommended. Yeah, but it's also important for you to be aware of, you know, signs and symptoms to get help if necessary. You know, how would you be able to tell what are some different strategies that their psychologist or psychiatrist might be working through with them? When would you need to call for help? All that kind of stuff can be really helpful to know. And yeah, you might even ask to attend an appointment with them if you are supporting someone with bipolar, just to get, I guess, a different perspective and deepen your understanding and education into their disorder, and, you know, without being intrusive, like from a, I guess, a place of support. But communication is really important. So lots and lots of communication can help build trust with someone and help, I guess, you understand a little bit more about them, and that can help the person suffering with bipolar feel a little bit less like a burden, because that is something that is often experienced by someone with bipolar, is they often feel like a burden to their friends and family. So letting them know that you love them and, you know, you're there for them and you're there to listen without judgment, but you're also getting really well-informed advice and strategies on how to support someone, and also getting support for yourself too.
Yeah, education is so important, isn't it? And I think education really provides that, the explanation for behavior. It takes away some of the blame or the frustration that family members or support networks might have for that person who's suffering bipolar. They might learn that, oh, it's not you that's choosing to spend all our money or to get aggressive. It's actually the bipolar. It's actually, you know, chemicals in our brain that are unfortunately really hard to control. And I think it's also good to know that bipolar is not due to bad parenting. It's nobody's fault. It's just a DNA thing. And I think also bipolar makes good people do, quote, bad things. It's not, they don't wake up and choose, you know, people with bipolar don't wake up and think, oh, I can't wait to spend my money today. It's something that unfortunately is quite automatic and it's sometimes quite hard to control. So education is so wonderful for taking away some of that blame and acknowledging bipolar, it's a serious mental health concern.
Definitely. So above all, I think it's important to remember that bipolar disorder is very treatable, and medication therapy and other interventions can play a huge role in managing symptoms and slowing rapid mood changes.
Okay, so let us jump into Q&A. Amy, tell me about some questions that you would like answered. And by you, I mean our listeners.
Okay, question number one. How can I overcome a dysfunctional relationship with my mom? She always plays the victim.
Good question. This is honestly, Ames, I feel like we've gotten heaps of questions lately about boundaries, toxic relationships, boundary crossing. So it's really interesting. And I wonder if this is A, because more people are writing into us, or B, it's a product of a lot of people being at home with their mothers or people a lot more. Great question though. I think it's good. I mean, we say this for a lot of our Q&As. Obviously, we can't give you personalized psychological advice. We don't know your story. We can just offer general information. But I think exploring what is the dysfunctions of the relationship, what makes it so dysfunctional, pinpointing that.
What I will generally say, without knowing the background to this question, and with not having a lot of context, that healing dysfunctional relationships begins with you. So these are your feelings and your attitudes. And that does not imply that your parents are going to change, because they won't, but you will. And how you feel towards them will change. So sometimes, and again, this varies depending on the circumstance. Obviously, if this is a abusive dysfunctional relationship, then that's very different. But sometimes it is about working on ourselves to understand that our parents have their own attachment issues and wounds from their childhood. And that's what we're kind of seeing here in these dysfunctional dynamics. I think having a pet, I think, it, again, like you said, Kat, understanding, I guess, the unspoken rules and different communications, different triggers. So having a parent who plays the victim habitually means that children are not free to discuss things with them. Mm-hmm. So they are not heard, because they are taught directly and indirectly that their feelings and needs are not the ones that matter. So there's no point bringing anything up, because mum's got more important and bigger problems than I do. So I think it's about having a conversation. I think when we have attachment issues or childhood trauma, we forget that we're not a child anymore. And, you know, we often speak about nurturing the inner child. And I think, in a really simplistic way, what can be helpful is taking a little bit of power in no longer being a child. You can have a conversation with your mom now about how her behavior impacts you. So it's about being really respectful, but also assertive, and, you know, having those conversations around exactly what it is that is making you feel this way. And I also think trying to behave in a way that is different from the role that you usually played growing up, and paying attention to habits and defenses that you use in response to your mother's behavior that might trigger old responses when you're a child. And that can really help manage anxiety, stress, and anger within the relationship.
Great. I was also going to add something which I find is interesting. It's not answering the question, but it's interesting. When you go back to your childhood home and you go back into that family system that perhaps you live out of home, it's really common that you regress and go back into that child teenager role that you had when you were living with your parents. And I think that sometimes parents can often feel the same way. Parents can, you know, become that, you know, for example, an overprotective mother that's worried about their child or their teenager. And sometimes it's good to, as Ames was saying, set those boundaries and be really assertive, because sometimes you just need that shift in your role. And it's reminding your parents, or your mum in this case, I'm actually an adult now. I can make my own decisions. You don't need to baby me. You don't need to cross those lines. This is my boundaries, and you can choose to cross them or not. And I think it's really interesting. I've really noticed that personally as well, and professionally, that when people go back to their childhood homes, to their parents, they tend to regress back into what they were when they're living with their parents, with their mother or father or both.
Yeah, definitely. We actually had a question. This might segue really well into, we had a question on how to set boundaries. Any tips on setting boundaries? Because this person really struggled to set boundaries for herself.
Great question. I think we did an episode on this. Something about toxic relationships.
We did one in toxic relationships.
Yeah, yeah. I think we touched on setting boundaries in that, but I think quick 5-minute wrap up of that episode. Decipher what your boundaries are. So assess what is appropriate to you, what makes you feel uncomfortable versus what makes you feel comfortable. Writing it down, if you find it hard to verbalize, can really help. Sometimes it's really hard to set boundaries with people that we love because they might be so used to you being a people pleaser, or they might be so used to you saying yes, yes, yes to things that you're not okay with. So I can understand that there's a little bit of trepidation and hesitation when you put your foot down for the first time. That can sometimes be met with resistance and anger and frustration because that person isn't used to you putting your foot down. But I think it's just staying strong with that. The more that you stay strong and assert boundaries, the more people will respect them. It can take some time. You know, it's not going to happen the first go. The more that you show that you're not okay with them stepping over your boundaries, the more that they will eventually back away. So expect anger, expect frustration, expect a hissy fit, expect a meltdown. All of those things may happen, but being really strong and backing yourself. And if you can't verbalize it, write it down, write them a letter, write them an email. Practice it in front of the mirror, send them a voice. You know how people can send voice, what are they called? I'm so not with it. Heaps of people do it these days. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like a voice memo.
Yeah, a voice memo. You can send a voice memo. They're really awesome. But yeah, I think that would be my advice.
Definitely. I can sometimes struggle to set boundaries and honor boundaries once I've set them. Like, I make them up in my mind, but then actually articulating them and honoring them is a whole other ball game. So I completely sympathize with how difficult it can be to set boundaries, especially with family members. I think my top 3 things to do would be really clear about what your boundaries are. Like, think about what you actually want. For example, if you want your parent to stop calling you at work, or they keep coming over to your house and you really want space, something like that. Be really, really clear about exactly what you want to achieve from the boundary or what you want the boundary to be, and communicate that. I think open communication is crucial for realistic boundaries. I feel like sometimes, like Kat was saying, we can tend to worry that we're going to hurt someone's feelings, or if we've never, you know, communicated boundaries before, it can be a little bit tricky to suddenly start standing up for ourselves. But it's really important that we respectfully and, you know, assertively communicate what our boundaries are so that people know what to expect. When we communicate our boundaries clearly and respectfully, we get that respect in return, and people are more likely to, honor our boundaries. And then I think be consistent. You know, we can't one weekend say, no, absolutely not, we're not doing this. I don't like when you do this anymore, please don't do that. And then the next weekend, be okay with it. So I think that adds to confusion and sends mixed messages, and it also stops the other person from respecting our boundaries. So I think be very clear, communicate well, and be consistent with your boundary setting.
Yeah. And also letting them know what will happen when they cross a boundary and sticking to that. So for example, as you're saying, Ames, if they keep calling you at work, just say, look, if you keep doing that, I'm going to hang up from you. If you do that 3 days in a row, I'm going to block you, and be really consistent with that. Savage. I know that's savage, but I think sometimes you do need to warn them. And if they're not respecting that, you need to do that. And every time that they can step over the line, toe the line, and you know, nudge around a little bit and disrespect those boundaries, is more reason that they will keep doing it. I promise, the more that you respect yourself enough and, you know, respect and honor that boundary, the less likely they are to keep pushing it. But it's just, I find the hardest part is in the first few months of you're in almost a habit of saying, yes, that's fine, everything's okay, yes, you can do that. Oh, I guess, you know, I'm not comfortable, but I feel bad, or it's what I've always done, or I just don't want to cause a fuss. That is the hardest time. And I think just sticking to it and having friends or a support network to keep you accountable, to make sure that you follow up with your boundaries, is super helpful as well. But it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do, especially as Ames was saying, with family members.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. How to support your partner who is experiencing depression and suicidal thoughts, but is hesitant to seek support?
Great question. And I'm sorry that you are experiencing this. This is a really hard situation to be in as a partner. I think first and foremost, suicidal thoughts, if there is any intent, please, please, please call 000. If you notice any abnormal behavior, if this person has attempted before, if they have talk about having a plan, talk about what they're going to do, have a time frame, if they start to give away their possessions, if they start to feel really happy. I know that sounds really counterintuitive, but sometimes people, before they are planning to die by suicide, there might be a sense of relief and they might feel really happy. So checking those warning signs is so important. Ames and I did an episode on how to have that conversation, but if you don't feel comfortable, you don't have to do it. But I strongly recommend 000 if there is any intent to follow through with suicide. However, if there is that depression and those suicidal thoughts but no intent, still really important that you do link in as soon as possible with any mental health support that you can. Please go to your doctor. I think it's hard because you're not their therapist. Really good to preface that, because you might try and say all the right things and do all the right things, but if there is that risk to safety, you do need to get some immediate support as soon as possible.
Definitely. And I think it is super difficult when you have a partner or a loved one that is hesitant to seek support, and you can see that they are really, really needing some support. I think, like Kat was saying, there are lots of things you can do, from noticing changes in their behavior, you know, and just being a listening ear for them to talk to. I think it's also paramount to look after yourself. Supporting someone who experiences depression and suicidal ideation can often physically and emotionally drain you and can really take a toll on your health and well-being. So it's really important that you also make sure you have a good support network around you. And, you know, if you need it as well, Beyond Blue is an invaluable resource for information and support. So I urge anyone who might be in a similar position to check out Beyond Blue's website and Lifeline. Lifeline can be a great resource as well, not just for people who are in a crisis or experiencing emotional distress. It can also be a great service if you are feeling a little bit lost on how to support someone struggling with depression and suicidal thought. They might be able to run you through, you know, different conversations to have, make you feel a little bit more comfortable and reassured, because it can be a really helpless position to be in. Especially if they're not wanting to talk or access support, it can feel pretty terrible experiencing something like that. So make sure you are also reaching out for support.
Yeah, I think as well, when this person says that their partner is hesitant to reach out for support, really good here thing that you can do is normalizing that depression is really hard to live with. Experiencing suicidal ideation, that's really tough. And, you know, for someone who's probably gone through what they've gone through, it's hard. So validating their feelings and knowing that they're not, I guess, letting them know they're not a burden, you know, that you care for them, that you're there, whether, you know, whether they like it or not. And I'm sure that this person, it sounds like that if they've, you know, been so worried to reach out to us, that they're probably doing all the right things. I think people with depression feel like, A, they're a burden, B, they shouldn't be feeling like they are, they feel silly. You know, they try and keep things inside because they just feel embarrassed or they feel really silly for feeling the things that they do. So normalizing that feeling, saying, I get it. I get you're so upset. I'm so sorry you feel like that. I understand you had a hard day. You know, I know that's a trigger for you. So really validating, and that can help the other person feel really connected with you and can normalize as well. And also saying things like, people who do experience depression, it's likely that they will have thoughts of suicide, and that's normal to feel like that. You're not alone. You know, you're, it's really hard, and there's a reason why there are support services out there, so many support services, because depression is really hard to live with. So I think having conversations like that can be so helpful for someone who experiences depression, and, you know, it can really help them, even though they might not feel like, you might not feel like they're listening, or they might, you know, might think that they're not taking what you're saying. I think that validating and normalizing is such an easy thing to do, and can really, really help. So that is something, if you feel comfortable doing that, that can really help your partner. But please know that the onus is not all on you. And I think, even though they might be hesitant, just, as Ames was saying, Lifeline, you know, there's no commitment with Lifeline. There's lots of free services out there where there's not much commitment. There's online support. There's, you know, they can call their doctor. They don't have to go in. So there's a lot of services that are starting to become available for the people who perhaps are a little bit hesitant to reach out for support. And also, I know that telehealth today, actually it got announced that there's 10 extra sessions available for telehealth for those living in Victoria, but there's normal telehealth sessions rebates available if you're under a mental health care plan. So that might take away some of the hesitation. Okay, last question. Also, we got heaps of people writing in for the Q&A. So thank you so much, everyone. We try and get through them all, but
we'll just keep adding them to each Q&A segment. We'll get there eventually.
Yes, we haven't forgotten. We will be there. If you feel like we have forgotten a question, just DM us again and we will pop it in. Okay, last question. Any advice on feeling unsuccessful or unsatisfied as a stay-at-home mum?
I think this is something that's really overlooked, and I was excited to answer this question because I feel like there's a multitude of emotional challenges that stay-at-home mums go through. And I feel like stay-at-home mums are really trivialized when they do experience emotional challenges or any challenges. I feel like it's kind of, you know, stereotyped as, well, you don't have a job, so what do you have to complain about? But there are lots of things, and, you know, lots of challenges that stay-at-home mums go through, from juggling, you know, a hierarchy of different tasks every day, feeling really alone and isolated, you know, life satisfaction, lack of accomplishment, and, you know, I guess a sense of identity, to name a few. I think feeling lonely and bored is something really common that I hear a lot of stay-at-home mums struggling with. And I guess, yeah, that sense of losing their accomplishment or a sense of fulfillment.
Yeah, I think you've just birthed a child out of your vagina. I think that you've done already an amazing job by keeping a child alive. I think, as you said, Ames, it's sometimes overlooked, like, oh, being a mum, everybody does it, so it must be easy. It's absolutely so difficult. I mean, if the first 9 months are not hard, the next 18 years are really tricky. So really just acknowledging that, just because so many other people are mums and you look around and you think they're all doing so well, being a mum is damn hard. I think it's honestly the hardest job in the whole world. So really just remembering that, the fact you're keeping your child alive, man, everything else is a bonus. If you can put pants on and leave the house and manage to get a coffee, like, you're super mum. So I think just remembering that you are doing an amazing job. You're helping the world by carrying on your offspring. You know? So please remember that. It's just remembering the little wins in your day. If you can put pants on, if you can somehow have a shower, if you can do that, that is a success. I guess from a psych perspective as well, the time you spend with your child's not going to care if your house is messy. Your child is not going to remember that you didn't get the washing done. Your child is not going to remember, you know, that you went back to work a little bit later. What your child will know and what it will feel is that it felt love from you. And that, from a psych perspective, is a predictor for a lot of things in life. So that's resilience, it's physical, mental, psychological health. If you are loved as a child and you got that love from your primary caregiver, you've already set up your child for success and as much health as they can get. So just remember, if you love your child, and you might have days where you just feel frustrated, if you're loving your child and giving it that one-on-one attention and support, and you're helping your child with their milestones, and you're spending time with your child playing, you're being successful. You're doing so, so well for your child. You're doing so much more for your child than what you realize.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is definitely understandable to fall into the mindset of feeling a lack of accomplishment and a lack of fulfillment, given that I think a lot of mums or parents in general feel that your identity shifts from, you know, your pre-mum mm-hmm. identity into you are now a mum, and, you know, your sole role is now to look after your child. And that can present with a lot of difficulties and challenges and hurdles. Know that that is quite a common experience and you are not alone in experiencing that. I think what can be helpful if you are someone that is starting to really feel some of those emotional hurdles is not to keep questioning your parenting style. I think if that is something that you question, it's a sign of great parenting. It means that you really care about being the best parent you can be. I think parents in general feel a lot of guilt and are really critical and hard on themselves, but there is no such thing as the perfect parent. There is no perfect way to parent. I think the best thing you can do is focus on what you are doing right and celebrate what you are doing right, and give yourself a little bit of kindness and self-compassion rather than beating yourself up, because stay-at-home mums are some of the hardest workers that I know, especially if you have a child with a disability or an injury or an illness. I work with a lot of children that have, you know, anything from learning impairments to chronic illness to pretty severe disabilities. And those stay-at-home mums are absolute heroes. Mm. And I know that oftentimes they sit in my room sobbing with some unimaginable, you know, scenarios and situations. And I just think it's about, and I know it's a lot easier said than done, but finding accomplishment, purpose, and fulfillment in those everyday wins, celebrating all the things that you are doing right as a parent, working hard and doing your best is what matters. And, you know, maybe down the track, it's about exploring, you know, your passions in other things. But I think managing the frustrations of life at home with a kid is the biggest job that you will ever do. And if, you know, if you're doing that, then you're doing a great job.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It is such a hard, exhausting job, and with little rewards sometimes and little validation from other people. So yeah, as Ames is saying, find that accomplishment in another way. Make sure that you, if you need, I know there is that mum guilt with taking time away from your child, but it's so important that you fill your cup up, because your child will pick up on that. So having a day off to do things that make you feel good, whether that's just getting a sleep in, going for a walk, doing painting, finding something that you love to do pre-baby, pre-child, find that passion again, meet up with other mums who you can talk to as well. So I think make sure you know, have that time for yourself, because I think that helps with a little bit of the sanity and helps you to remember those accomplishments that you have, and you're a bit more of your identity. I think we've talked about this in a previous episode, but I think when you become a mum, it kind of morphs into a mum identity. The identity of pre-baby is forgotten about. So finding that if you loved going to the gym, if you felt really good, I don't know, playing tennis, if you love to be a painter, if you love to sing, making sure that you don't lose sight of those. And if possible, putting them back into your everyday life, even just a little bit. I think that would really help with that feeling of the accomplishment and the purpose. But just a reminder, you're doing a wonderful, wonderful job.
Alrighty, I think that is all we have time for today.
Thank you so much for tuning in, guys. We really appreciate it. And also quickly just want to say a huge thank you to everyone for your support on the launch of the Site Collaborative. We really appreciate all the shares, the likes, the DMs. If you want to go and have a follow, we are on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters and now at The Site Collaborative.
Yay.
All right, guys, we will catch you next episode. Bye. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode. If you want to see more, please follow us on Instagram at The Psychology Sisters. To make sure that you never miss another episode, please hit the subscribe button in the podcast app. If you know someone who might enjoy this episode, we would love you to share this with them. Please note the content shared in this episode is purely educational and does not replace personalized advice from a mental health professional. See you next week for more spicy science and sexy self-help.